Hey there, come on in. It's time for Right Club. The first rule of Right Club is we don't talk about Right Club, but for you, we're breaking the rule.
Hello, I'm Steph, and I'm here with Nicola.
Hello.
Teresa.
Hi.
Pat.
Hi.
And Linda.
Hi.
And later today, we're going to be joined also by Heather,
our friend
who we've been talking about but not met yet. One of our listeners, Lucy Honey Linda, wrote on the Right Club, the podcast Facebook group recently, and she said that she woke up in the middle of the night and an idea came into my head. It was inspired by you ladies. So thank you, Lucy. It's always nice to get positive feedback, and I'm glad that we're sparking some ideas and giving you some inspiration. Right, so on the show today, we're going to hear Nicola read from her work in progress. She's going to read from her as-yet-unnamed book one of the Taurus Trilogy. Pat's going to be talking about another crime against the English language that she's identified. And then we're going to listen to an interview that we recorded a few days ago with Heather Worsley, and Nicola and myself. And we met with Catherine De Bona and Julian Cohen. And that's all about the therapeutic benefits of writing. And then Heather will tell us what's on her bedside table, and she'll be joined by Amanda Staples, who will be interviewing next week. Amanda's a playwright. You'll hear all about her next week. She's also going to tell us what's on her bedside table. But first, we've just got time for Linda to ask us to
name the novel.
Yes, okay. Clue number one. This novel was set in the mid-17th century in Boston in a society governed by the Puritans. It was one of the first mass-produced publications in the United States. Stop it. Just shush, both of you.
Oh, I might have a glimmer.
I don't know. I'm not there.
Okay. And the rest of that sentence, which was interrupted, is, and its wide distribution made the author famous. Okay, we have Pat and Teresa who are screaming out that they have it.
Maybe.
And clue number two. The novel tells the story of two lovers who ran afoul of Puritan moral law and the consequences they suffer for such behavior. Well, Steph's shaking her head no. Nicola's shaking her head.
No.
Third clue is a quote. Ah, but, interposed more softly, a young wife holding a child by the hand. Let her cover the mark as she will. The pang of it will be always in her heart. All right. Teresa.
Is it The Scarlet Letter?
It is.
By Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Yes, Patty. Yes.
You both got that on the first clue.
Yes.
Absolutely. So okay. That's 3 points each.
May I say that when you're writing these clues, it's very difficult to know which one is what's going to be difficult and what's going to be not as you're going down trying to make them less difficult from 1, 2, 3. And so apparently my clue number one was totally easy. It should have been number three.
Not for me. Not for me.
Oh, I think we should have three clues of equal standing.
Number three gave it as well.
Yeah.
I think I have to say, I only know this novel because I taught in America for a year and it was on the syllabus there. I've never heard of it.
Oh, really? Right. No. It's been dramatised, hasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't actually read it, but I'm aware of it.
Yeah. And, you know, it's still on every reading list across the United States, at least in the high school.
17th century person.
And so.
Right, well, following on from last week, where Teresa scored 3 and I scored 2 in the novel, this week Teresa and Pat have both scored 3. So the scores on the doors so far are Teresa on 6, girly swapped, Pat on 3, me on 2, and Nicola and Linda are tailing
zero.
Big fat zeros. Yes.
Never mind.
They're so much neater than other numbers, nice, aren't they, those two?
There's a perfection in that.
Yeah.
Right, Nicola, we're going to hear from you reading your work in progress now from book one of the tourist trip trilogy. So over to you.
Brace yourselves, ladies. You're about to meet the aliens. "You must be bloody joking," roared Dick, ambassador for the Damali. "Have you lost your effing minds?" Everyone gasped in admiration at his quick grasp and liberal use of appropriate English epithets. Since the announcement of this season's parliamentary theme, all 11 alien races had been scrambling to choose appropriate human names, align themselves with the human culture, and learn their chosen language pronto, along with the most colourful swear words possible. Dick waggled his magnificent horny crest in outrage, which rampaged unfettered from his nostril slits to tail tip, and which changed colour regularly from a beautiful cool blue-green to a fiery dark red in seconds, depending on his mood. Today was most definitely a dark red day. His eyes burned alternately black and orange in complement to his fiery crest. Several of the other ambassadors around the room wondered about the safety of the faux wood Tudor replica furniture around him. Some of the more combustible species moved surreptitiously away from the reach of his fiery breath. Granted, the Vodgin regularly have huge leaps of intuitive intelligence, sometimes at several places in the world at the same time, and they act on them fast, usually just to get a step ahead of the others in their pathetic power games. There's no long-term plan. They are just winging it. As all of the ceiling fans swung as one towards him and a damp mist started to descend from the overhead fire prevention system, in an effort to keep the room temperature at a happy medium for all the ambassadors, Dick voted loudly and violently, slapping his muscular tail on the floor for emphasis. Against! Next to him sat Octavia, ambassador for the Somalchia. Her nearer four tentacles kept reaching out to Dick as he sat down, in an effort to connect with his psyche and help him calm down, but he rather rudely brushed her off. Every time one of her gentle appendages got near enough to his scales, a rather alarming hissing noise was broadcast through the translation system, sounding just like drops of cold water on a hot stove. Octavia, usually known more formally as Her Excellence, Grand High Queen of the First Family of Somachia, rose next and pulled her tentacles back, adjusting her formal Japanese kimono and smoothing it down with satisfaction as she walked to the centre of the magnificent room. She knew the drop shoulders suited her, as did the rich blue background of the heavily embroidered satin fabric. A large grey skull gleamed opalescent as one of her rear limbs discreetly sprayed a mist of essential lubricant over her head from behind. The wide waistband and large formal bobby was just the right height to push her eight tentacles up and out and show them off to her best advantage, but sadly this effect was rather lost on her fellow politicians this evening. She delicately put several of her suckers together quite precisely and bowed formally before speaking. "I think some of the Vodgin show real promise. The pagan religions and followers of Buddhism are growing in popularity again, and even that old curmudgeon David Attenborough is beginning to see, and even say publicly, that global warming is a real thing, and what happens in one part of their beautiful planet affects the other parts. We, the Somachia, are therefore firmly for," she said to a small but enthusiastic ripple of applause. Sir David had a big fan base in the Federation, with families of all races settling down to watch his popular television series on a Sunday night, or whatever the local equivalent was. Elizabeth stood next to vote for the Shikari, slightly stiff and uncomfortable looking in her raw silk, primrose formal dress and coat set, topped off by a rather risque feathered hat by popular human milliner of the late 20th century, Philip Tracy. The wide brim hid her features, but they all knew that her delicately scaled pale green features would be pulled into a series of firm horizontal and vertical lines. "We Shikari are against, with no prevarication. They are squandering that planet, and any positive moves to look after it are coming too little too late. And if we don't step in soon, it will all be wasted and unusable for at least 10 millennia. In fact, we think we should go in now as a preemptive strike, relocate the lot of them and make them start from scratch again." The Shikari was not known for giving any race a second chance. They could not abide a waste of any kind and felt that every race should be held 100% responsible for looking after their home planet from day one. As she sat down, Elizabeth sighed and discreetly scooped a small handful of semi-sticky purple goo off the seat next to her. As her longtime friend Frederick squidged rather noisily to take the centre stage for his vote, she slapped it back onto his departing shoulder as quietly as possible. Fred represented the Thurza, known for their acceptance of any race, even the more warlike ones. They were also known for their rather casual attitude to their constantly dropping body parts, the propensity for which was heightened when they were forced into confrontational situations such as this, the first of three votes that will decide the fate of the Vodgin, also known colloquially as humans. You really had to watch where you walked when the Federation was in session, or you could hear pained squeals from Fred as you trod on the equivalent of his toes and fingers left in the last room he had occupied. I am sure if we took them into the Federation sooner rather than later, we could work on them more effectively and bring them up to speed more quickly. It's so hard for them to sort themselves out down there all on their own, he said sympathetically, before delivering the vote of his people. Four, his translator bud said loudly. The first vote continued around the room, ending up with the Tin, Esbon, Natheth, Damali, and Shikari against, with the Samachia, Dorori, Faida, and Thirza four, leaving only the Femi and Aisa still undecided. Did you keep up, ladies?
Oh, yes. You know, Nicola, I, as you know, I've never been a fan of science fiction. In fact, I've never read but one or two books. And I was fascinated with this and delighted when I read through. I love the characters. And it, so you're so imaginative, having things fall off somebody. And
yeah, that's right. That's
really I love it. And I liked also this phrase about the ceiling fans swinging as one towards the sky. I thought, oh, that's a nice visual image to see them all go. I like the automation there. And people with... the more combustible species having to move away from fiery old Dick, you know. Well, I just can tell you, I actually love this, and it's making me think, well, maybe science fiction is something I ought to give a little more consideration to. But I'll just wait for this and read yours first. I loved it.
Thank you.
I think it's the humour.
Yeah, it's very Adams-esque, Douglas Adams-esque.
Yeah.
But also, what's great is the way you start right in the middle of the situation without any preamble, without any explanation.
Right.
I think that's really effective. And all the little details about the physical attributes that come out, and so we're getting to know these different species, and individuals gradually. You're introducing that information. So I think that's very, very effective. Mm. To me, it seems very original. You know, but as I haven't read much of this style, I can't really judge that. But it seems like you've put a lot of thought and time into getting these details and the names and the different creatures. And of course, the difficulty of creating an environment that is comfortable for all of these different species, if I can use that. It's really...
The practicalities
really
fascinate me.
It's like trying to get a fish and a horse in the same room. So I thought that was really, really inspired as an idea.
Okay.
If I was going to say something negative, and it's probably just me, but I'm not entirely convinced about them watching David Attenborough. But I love the humour of it.
No, I agree with everything that's been said. There was one place where I wondered about the grammar, but I'm sure Pat will pick
us up. Oh, there's plenty of places where we'll be wondering about the grammar.
Magnificent, horny, pressed in outrage, which rampaged unfettered from his nostril slits to his tail tip. So was it the outrage which was rampaging unfettering? His horny crest.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sure there are things that Pat can help you with on that. If I had to say what to watch out for in your edits, and this may be deliberate on your part, but there's quite a lot of repetition in terms of, like you said, appropriate English, appropriate human names,
okay.
And then another couple of paragraphs down, you've got a fiery crest and fiery breath.
Yeah.
Mm.
And then you've got rather rudely and rather alarming. One sentence after the other. Now, that may be deliberate.
No, thesaurus.
So I would say watch out for repetition and see if you can find different words.
Yeah.
But yes, the characters are really quite... I'm getting an image of them, but very imaginative, you know, bits dropping on people and purple goo.
And I think what's lovely is that these bizarre-looking creatures, you actually... make them quite sympathetic to the reader. Even the guy with the bits of purple goof on him. Which, you know, is a beard. You know, he's a nice guy.
Yeah,
they have personality as well as physical.
Yeah, right.
It's all come from the initial research about the names, which we know. There's three things you've said today that you liked that actually come from being in Right Club.
Yeah.
So, you know, originally doing the research about the names, and then I looked at the characteristics of the... Then I actually went and found names for each character that, that reflected the characteristics of their species. And that just made the characterisation so much easier.
Right. So the,
That's fabulous.
So the Dick is the ambassador for the Dumali. So what does Dumali mean?
Off the top of my head, I can't without consulting my alien race.
Dumali has a meaning.
Yeah, every race name has a meaning. Every human, every name of the person embodies the characteristic of the race, and that just made it Richard. It must be fire, you know, a fiery independent. I think it's independence that race.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I've got a list of all the race names and their racial characteristics as you know, names. So it really helped. Yeah. It really helped.
It's brilliant.
Excellent. That's good.
No, and it's not anything to do with grammar or language. Maybe it's just me understanding. I wondered whether knowing that the Vajin was with the humans could possibly have come sooner.
I didn't want it to. Really.
Yeah, I thought that was that was clear, and you didn't need to say also known colloquially as humans. Oh. I thought let us work that out for ourselves.
Well, that's clear to me at all.
Okay, so but there you go, difference of opinion there. But as you read it, I thought, yeah, you don't need to tell us that.
Show, not tell, kind of thing.
Yeah,
it was fun to write, and it was really, you know, as I read it again, and I'd read it out several times, I picked up on words that I'd doubled up on and things like that. So
I did notice a structural thing here. I've got to underline it. Octavia kept reaching out to Dick as he sat down in an effort to connect with his psyche, and I thought, if he sat down to connect with his psyche, was kind of strange. She was reaching out to him.
Oh, right.
It's a structure thing there.
Yeah, we need lots of help on this front. I'm scared because this is, you know, there's a lot of sci-fi like this, so I'm scared I'm not being original enough. But I'm
that was the point I was making. It seems very original, but I'm not fit to judge that.
No,
but you know,
I'm not competent.
I have a book. It's on my Kindle, but it's called The Art of Stealing, and. And you have to always keep in mind that there are only so many plots and so many things
exactly.
in the world.
I mean,
those
were the Grace and Mary thing as well, wasn't it? You know, Dick, don't try too hard to be original.
I'll be putting it through my own filter.
Yeah.
But good sci-fi makes you believe in the characters.
Yes.
You know, and no matter how upset
whatever the genre,
they are.
You have to care about the characters.
Yeah.
We should be recording.
I think it will. It was really very, very interesting to me.
Cool. And amusing. Right.
And amusing.
Thank you, Nicola. Well, Pat, you're sitting there with your truncheon and your whistle.
Hello.
You've identified another crime against the English language. So what have you got to talk to us about this week?
Well, this is one of the things that really drives me demented. It's the one that, you know, I actually shout at the TV. Especially when I hear it on BBC News, because I always think, well, they should know better. I heard it there. And that's the difference between less and fewer.
Oh, right.
Uh-huh. Really annoys me when I hear people saying that, you know, oh, they're going to be less words in this next version or whatever it is. It just sounds wrong. And it bugs me that people don't see it. But yeah, there is an actual rule, but as with all rules, it, you know, it gets broken and has exceptions. But basically, you use less when you're referring to something that can't be counted or doesn't have a plural. So, for example, money, time, music, rain. So it's a better job, but they pay you less money. So you wouldn't ever say, you know, they'd pay you few money or fewer money, would you? People want to spend less time in traffic jams. Mm-hmm. I think that's fairly easy. Less
it's a really good way of remembering. If you can't count it, it's less.
Yeah.
If you can count it, it's fewer.
By and large.
Here we go.
Yeah. Now, I mean, it's also used with numbers and with expressions of measurement and time. So their marriage lasted less than 2 years. So, yes, you can count years, but you wouldn't actually say fewer than 2 years in that particular case. Or we are less than 2 miles from the station.
It's when you don't know an exact number, you just use that.
So, or it's they're not meant to be looked at or taken separately, individually. Mm. It's a global number, if you like. His weight fell from 18 stone to less than 12.
Right.
Yeah, to fewer than 12 stones. Mm. But you wouldn't ever say that. Mm. So I think most people tend not to use fewer in place of less, but there are often people using less instead of fewer, and I think that's the one, the bit that really annoys me. But few is used to emphasise how small a number of people or things is. And so if you can count them, and or you're referring to things in the plural, then you use fewer. So she had few enemies, because you can actually count, you're talking about a number of people. If you're talking about people or things in the plurals, you can be talking houses, newspapers, students, children. People these days are buying fewer newspapers. Fewer students are opting to study science-related subjects, and so on.
People are having fewer children.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but this is a running gag in Game of Thrones.
Oh, is it?
And if you go the very popular television series, Kings, there's one king in particular who's got the same bugbear as you, and he's constantly mentioning it in the background.
Do your knuckle bones bring you luck?
Well, life's been good since you hacked them off, Your Grace. And there's four less fingernails to clean.
Fewer.
Pardon?
Four fewer fingernails to clean. Let them die.
We got our own to worry about. Less enemies for us.
Few.
Apparently there was a big thing couple of years ago, I vaguely remember, when supermarket checkouts, you know, they used to have the 10 items or less, five items or less.
Yeah.
lots of people, you know, disgusted of Tunbridge Wells, said, but surely it should be fewer. And lots of people jumped on this bandwagon and said, oh, yes, of course, grammatically it should be five items.
So is it fewer in Waitrose, but less in
Waitrose?
Less in Waitrose.
But, no, because it's the total amount, then less is actually correct. Fewer would be excessively pedantic. And pedantic though I may be on some things,
This is the difficulty. It's knowing what limits to put on your pedantry, isn't it?
So maybe it sounds right.
Yes, yeah.
Then it probably is right. Mm. But then the more you hear something, the more it starts to sound right.
Yeah.
And that's...
Yeah.
And I suspect what you would think sounds right is completely different to what I would think sounds right.
Might be.
And, of course, language and language use evolve.
It changes.
And what was right becomes, you know, old-fashioned.
Yeah. Absolutely. But there's always going to be that sort of transitional.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for that, Pat. We'll have to... be very wary of fewer mistakes.
Thank you.
Whoa. I'm on fire. Okay, we're going now to listen to an interview that Heather and Nicola and I recorded a few days ago. We met with Catherine de Bona, who is the author of Girl in the Shadows, which was published by HarperCollins in March 2017. And along with her, we met with Julian Cohen, who is a tutor and creative writing group leader. And we were talking to them about how writing has therapeutic benefits. So we'll listen to the interview now.
My name's Catherine de Bona. I am, for all intents and purposes, a stay-at-home mum and wife to a workaholic husband. I used to be an investment banker, but have always written stories, poetry, and the like. I sent out my second novel just before the summer and had mixed responses from agents. I had 9 request the full manuscript, and of those 9, 8 of them said that they loved the writing but felt that the story wasn't commercially viable, so would love to see whatever else I wrote. At which point I kind of banged my head against a brick wall and thought, well, what is it that they want? Because they're all telling me what they don't want, but not telling me what they do want. So I went away and wrote the opening chapters to two more books and then kind of went, none of this is working. I was brushing my teeth one night before I went to bed, just kind of thinking, I'm going to give it up. I'm going to do something completely different. And this little mini film played out inside my mind. I could see the entire book, the entire story in my mind. So I thought, okay, that's got to be some kind of sign from whatever you want, however you want to interpret it. And thought, okay, I'll give it a go. At the same time, I went to the doctor with some health symptoms that were dismissed as being what they classified as perimenopausal, so the precursor to the menopause. I thought it was a bit dismissive, also because I have a family history of the condition that I was concerned about. So we're in the fortunate position where I have health insurance. So I went for a second opinion, which resulted in an operation just before Christmas. And I have ongoing treatment now. It was caught early, so it's fine. But there was a period of not knowing how severe everything was going to be. Clearly, I have a family history of this, and I have two young children and a workaholic husband. So all sorts of things going through my mind. And I was at home by myself whilst the children were at school, long periods of time where all you can do is try not to look up symptoms on the internet. So I sat down and started writing. I've spoken to Steph and Nicola a little bit before about how usually I would sit and plot and plan and write a chapter and print it out and toss it up and then carry on. But if there's anything that I'm ever unsure of, I write it in capital letters. For some unbeknown reason to me, I decided to write from the very beginning in capital letters, thinking if this doesn't work, it doesn't matter because it's just rough. It's not real because it's in capital letters. And it literally poured out of me. I am a very visual person, and anything that I ever write, I see the film of what I see the pictures in my mind, but this was a complete film in my head from the word go. And for want to steal another writing buddy's terminology, I word vomited 72,000 words in just over 3 weeks.
Wow.
And it was because it was taking me to a completely different place. Writing does anyway, but this was I guess my form of therapy, my way of putting all that stress and all that emotion and all that energy into something better than if I just sat and wallowed and worried and just, yeah. So I think there are a couple of people who've read early drafts of it and they have said that it does read like a film. So I'm keeping everything crossed for this one because I kind of like to think that it's my grandmother who is the one who always encouraged me to write, and it's her name that I write under, kind of giving me a kick up the backside and saying, come on, get on with it. There's more to this than what you think there is. So it's kind of for her as well.
Mm. That's lovely. Are you feeling well now?
I'm better now. I had quite a rough period over Christmas because unfortunately the operation was a success, but I had a hemorrhage.
Mm.
So it's just the bruising that kind of went with it, which slowed down my recovery. Mm. And also with two young kids, I was in and out of hospital. I didn't stay. I had to come home so they can physically see that I'm okay. Mm. Especially my youngest. She's a bit of a mummy's girl. And wanted to know that I was fine. And it is that the less they know, the better. So if they can see that I'm up and I'm not in bed, then they're not going to worry. My mum was brilliant. My mum's been fantastic. But it, I think it's with anything else, if you have to get up and carry on, it's being a mum, you get up and you carry on as normal. It doesn't matter if you've got the flu or if you've broken your leg, as a friend of mine in Australia has. She's got 3 under 5 and a husband out of work. She's got to carry on with a broken leg, but you somehow you do. But I think if I hadn't had this flash, this vision, whatever you want to call it, I think it would have been a lot harder. It's given me something else to focus on.
To channel all that anxiety and energy.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And just doing something every day rather than wallowing or you know, being unhealthy.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, we hope that you continue to recover. Nicola, tell us about your experience.
Well, I was someone who kept a diary as a teenager, not a journal, but just, you know, recording every day what happened. I found what I wanted to do, which was I've written a book called The Money Gym, which was a business book. And I had a coaching program and a mentoring program, and I was doing events, and it was all going incredibly, incredibly well. And then the whole economy crashed in 2000. I remember exactly when it was. It was January 2010 that my business partner said to me, we're going to have to close the business. So suddenly I'd spent all my life not having a mission, found my mission, exploited it and loved it and lived it, slept it, ate it, whatever. And then suddenly it was all taken away. And worse than that, all my money was taken away and my kids had to go and live with their dad and I was homeless. And it was just a really sudden cataclysmic event, really. I came out to Greece for a month or two because I had enough money just to do that on the easy jet flight. It was cheap out here. And then I went back and I was literally sleeping in my sister's spare room. And it got to January 2011 and my confidence was just at an all-time low. I just didn't know what to do next. I didn't know if I was any good at anything. I was going to my local Chamber of Commerce and I couldn't give my marketing services away. And I just didn't know what to do. My head was a mess. And so what I started, one of my mentors said that he journals and he just sits down every morning and he writes until he's spent. So I thought, I'm going to do that. So I got myself a Moleskine diary because everything has to be done just right. And I started to write. And I wrote I remember January the 18th, 2011. And I wrote every single day pretty much until just last year, really. I still do it, but not as often. I journal about twice a week now. And literally what I was finding was that when my head got so full of wheeling, swirling, negative thoughts I couldn't contain anymore, if I just sat down and wrote them all out, it made me feel better. Because once they're all out, they're not in your head anymore. And you get a sense of peace and emptiness and relaxation that you don't have when it's all swirling around all the time. So I found it incredibly powerful.
I found an interesting article about Jill Dawson, who's a writer of a number of books, including Fred and Eddie, which was shortlisted for the Whitbread Novel Award and the Orange Prize. Wild Boy, Watch Me Disappear, which was longlisted for the Orange Prize. She's had a Richard and Judy summer read. She's done well with her books. She said, although that there is a gulf of difference between journaling and creative writing, she said that she kept a journal since she was 9. And she's actually said in this article, it has helped me personally and also made me a better writer, because going over and over something eventually makes it clearer. A dream you don't understand may make sense 2 years later. Now, obviously, when you take that writing, it undergoes something of a transformation before it comes out as a fictional story. But I think we all know as writers that we take things that we've heard, things that we've seen, things that we've experienced, and make our characters endure them on occasion. So I'm sure there's a lot of there's a lot of evidence in that. Now, Julian, you actually work with people using writing as therapy, don't you?
Yeah, I have a bit of a background in counselling, psychotherapy, mental health, drugs, sex, all sorts of things. And about 3 years ago, I started this work. And I started it because I'm a trustee here in Buxton of a local community mental health project that supports people who are very isolated and have long-term mental health problems, and most of them are heavily medicated. And I started a group with them, which is still going. And in fact, in an hour's time, I've got to run up the hill to run it. It's been going once a fortnight for 3 years now. And I just found it really powerful. I mean, I found, you know, journaling or writing myself out, as Catherine was describing, really, as you both were describing, really important. But there's something very special, potentially, and magical, that's the right word, of using writing in a group setting. So I work as a kind of facilitator. Each time the group meets, I bring in writing activities, very short ones, stories, poems, and get people to write there and then in the moment. And also I place a lot of emphasis on people reading to each other. In fact, I put a lot of emphasis on how we read out and the rhythm of how we read out and listen to other people. So there's a lot of discussion. I met Heather when I ran a group at Blythe House, which is a hospice for people with cancers and life-threatening illnesses, and found it worked really well there. In the last few years, I've continued working there. Also worked with some young people here in Buxton who were regarded as beyond the pale. And the first time I ran a class there, I was told they had no levels of of concentration. And the first group session I ran was from 2:15 to 4:15, 2.5 hours. And the only person who left the room was me and old geezer because I needed to go to the toilet. The young people had every so-called psychiatric label under the sun, which I object to. And because I engaged them in a way that was meaningful to them, they wrote, they read out, they discussed, they laughed, they cried, and it was wonderful. So I work in a very intuitive way. I work with where people are at, what they say they want, what I perceive they might need. And all my groups are boringly the same. Every group session is a check-in. Check everyone's okay. Within a couple of minutes, I like everyone to have spoken. Then we have homework, which is always voluntary. And people would have written stuff in the intervening between the group sessions. And people read that out. Then we do a main writing activity. Then we talk about what the next homework would be. Then we have any other business. And we have a closing round. And most of my groups are 2 hours with no break at all. And I just love doing it. It's a real privilege. And I think it's quite magical the way you have a blank piece of paper in front of you and with the right atmosphere and support and dynamic and stimulus, suddenly that piece of paper, one piece of paper, two pieces of paper, three pieces of paper, is full of words. And people are often amazed. They say, where did that come from? And it comes from somewhere deep inside often. But the really interesting thing with the groups is that being shared between people. And the amount of laughter, the amount of tears, it's all very real. You know, writing allows people to be real with themselves and each other. People to share in ways they would otherwise find difficult. Allows us all to be vulnerable, but very supportive to other people. I love the work. And it's interesting, I've tried a few times to communicate with other people who do this work. And sometimes I communicate well with them, but I'm quite a difficult character in my own way. And I find it difficult sometimes. Therapeutic writing, there's a lot of flowery stuff around. And I'm not flowery at all about it. Well, you know that, don't you, Heather?
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be interesting to ask Heather because she's experienced this stuff. So she can tell.
I was going to come on to ask that and also to ask her if she's been writing about her knee.
I started as a volunteer and I thought I'd be coming along and making the tea and helping people, and I ended up being part of the group and Julian made the tea. We got an incredible bond between us because we did share, and as Julian said, we shared the tears, the laughter. I'd never written a thing before. I'd never put pen to paper creatively ever. And I found that, you know, I started, and once I started, I can't stop. You know, I can sit down and just, you know, it all just spills out and I can write for hours. Whether it's any good or not, it's going to be totally different. But it was a really, really good atmosphere, and it was very, very, you could see people growing
and getting over the trauma, being able to share all that. It was absolutely amazing.
There is a lot of evidence. There's been research done. Again, you know, I've looked at several scholarly articles, and you know, psychologists completely understand the benefits of writing. And you know, if you don't want to share it with somebody, you know, just writing a letter and then throwing it away has that cathartic effect. As Nicola described, it wasn't something you shared with people.
And you know, I lost my partner March 2016, so you know, a year and a bit ago, and I could join Write Club, and I spent quite a lot the first few months writing either stories about him or how I felt, or you know, I'd write sort of fiction, but it was cathartic because I didn't feel like I could talk to anyone about what had happened. You know, I couldn't talk to his mum. My family had heard it all before. Didn't want to keep boring people. Didn't want to keep crying on people. But making my as you said, inflicting my feelings on my characters was a very cathartic thing. Okay. And now I'm ready to go on and write about something else now.
Yeah.
And I think that works really well for individuals. So there's the kind of individual therapeutic work we can all do. But then there is also, you know, a great potential in groups of people meeting up together and working together.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Because I've got a 22-year-old and a 20-year-old, and I don't think they've ever written a word in their lives, except they do compose endless texts to each other and their friends, and they all seem to be in text groups. So that doesn't count as writing, though, because it's not physical in the real world, is it? I think there's a real magic in writing something physically in the real world. And as you say, the empty bit of paper that was empty before and now has something on it that wasn't there before.
It was interesting when I first did the group at the college, and one of the students came in with a laptop and said, I want to write with a laptop. And I said, you can't. And they said, all my teachers allow me to write with a laptop. And I said, yeah, but they're restricting your imagination, and I'm going to really explode your imagination.
Right. Well, I'm sure that's going to get lots of reaction. saving trees and all that sort of thing.
There's nothing, I mean, but remember, the activities I use are very short.
Yes.
And I have a really strong belief that everyone can write in a really, really interesting way.
Yeah.
And what's incredible is quite a few of the people I've worked with, very working class background, very little formal education, have regarded themselves as complete academic failures who can't string two words together. Mm. And they write some wonderful stuff. Mm-hmm. But you know, to get them into writing, you have to use very simple writing activities, you know, things like sentence completion. So, for example, this afternoon in an hour, I'll be up the road with these people who have long-term so-called mental health problems. And I know there's going to be a few new people there today who have very little writing. And I want to get them writing about their hopes for 2018. So I've got a really, really simple sentence completion activity, which goes in 2018. And then there's all these phrases, I will, I want, I could, perhaps. And I'm going to say, choose at least 10, finish the sentences, muck up the order, think about the rhythm of it loud in your own head, really loud but silently, get the rhythm, and then you're going to read it out to people. They all do it, and it sounds fantastic. It's very emotional, the fact that
I'm sure.
I feel good about doing it.
Catherine, can we just come back to you very briefly? Because I imagine you've got to go and fetch the children soon, haven't you?
I've got a bit of time, but I'm okay. Yeah. I'm okay.
Okay. Can we just come back to you briefly? So I know that you say that you kind of lost yourself in your writing. How much of the experience that you were going through at the time with doctors and anxieties and what ifs and so on, how much of that did you channel into the story, or did you completely leave that behind?
It was none of it. I think it's a way of, I mean, talking about, Julia was saying about what comes out in the paper is quite surprising, almost when you least expect it.
Yeah.
And I think it's about tapping into your subconscious, tapping into what all the kind of creatives would call the muse, and what artists of old used to take drugs for, you know, or used to get drunk or stoned or high or whatever. And it's taking away the negativity, taking away the little voices of doubt that are in your head saying, this isn't good enough, or I can't do this, or this is a waste of time. So for me, it was more a way of shutting out that negative voice, whatever the negative voice was trying to tell me, you know, this kind of internal demon. And so there's nothing there in the story to do with, it could have gone in, and I think there was a moment where I thought I could put it in, but then I think it would have been there for the wrong reason.
Yeah.
So I think for me, it's more about the sort of the therapeutic process is shutting off the rational part of your mind, mm-hmm. and opening up what you get through meditation, or what people might call spiritual awakening, or other people would refer to as the hand of God. Everybody is going to interpret it in their own way, but it is that's something that isn't, in a way, I guess it's what you're like as children before the dictates of society and the rules and regulations, where you can just play and access different parts of your brain because they're still developing, because you want them to, before everything starts to be closed off and the day-to-day minutiae kind of and responsibilities kick in. So I think it's something that we're all born with, but as you go through puberty and into adulthood, it kind of gets pushed to the back a little bit, and so it's a way of tapping into it, I think.
In the business world,
I think that was really well put.
Yeah.
Mm. I think that's really well put. The way I sometimes think of it is being real. I don't know if you can relate to that.
Being real. I think it's having the courage to kind of say what you really want to, as opposed to what you think you're supposed to say.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And I thought you put it really well.
Thank you. I try. Yeah. I have my moments.
Well, you definitely have one then.
Sorry?
I said good luck with book three. Keep us informed.
Thank you. Thank you.
How you're going? 72,000 words in 3 weeks is even more than Heather can write. So that's remarkable. I think we ought to do one of those things like they do on Saturday Kitchen with cooking the omelette.
When I first met Heather, she wouldn't write any words.
Well, there you go. There you go.
So you're the man. You're the man who's let
you said you didn't have any words. Yeah. Did you? And you said she didn't have any words.
You've unleashed the most prolific writer in our group.
Well, that was really interesting, and yeah. I must confess that I think you may remember I wrote a poem last year.
You did.
And actually that was very much a therapeutic piece of writing, because I was walking and feeling quite sad about something, and then some ideas came into my head, and I went home and wrote the poem, and it came to you almost without any change or edit. Yeah. So I guess we all to a degree use writing as therapy.
Mm. Yeah, and I was very interested in the different therapeutic uses that came out through those interviews.
Mm. And I was fascinated by the whole capital letter thing. I wouldn't have thought that 70,000 words could pour out of you if you're writing in capitals.
Is she writing with a pen? Not just caps lock.
I don't know. Is it on a computer?
Well, that's interesting, because if it was on a computer, then I can see how you could do it. But if you're writing freehand, caps would definitely slow you down.
I assumed that she was on caps lock, and then at the end she could...
immediately reverting to the medieval.
The quill.
Shakespeare wrote with a feather.
So that was really useful. So thank you to Julian and Catherine and Heather. We hope Heather will be back with us very soon. But it was lovely to hear from her. And in fact, we're going to hear from Heather again now, because she's going to tell us what's on her bedside table.
I've just finished The Keeper of Lost Things by Ruth Hogan, and it's the debut novel. And interestingly, I didn't do this deliberately, but she's just getting over cancer. So she's been writing therapeutically. She had a car accident in early 2000s as well, which prompted her to start writing. It's just fascinating, really, that talking about therapeutic writing. Mm. This is light-hearted, fun, the charming novel. Beautiful for reading on the beach or by the pool. And it says, realizing he's running out of time, he leaves his house and all its lost treasures to his assistant Laura, the one person he can trust to fulfil his legacy and reunite the thousands of objects with their rightful owners. And it was really good. But I don't choose the books that I read. We've got a novel way of purchasing books in the Worsley household. Catherine, our daughter, she chooses them. She puts them on our Kindles and Roy pays for them.
So that's The Keeper of Lost Things by Ruth Hogan. Finally, we're going to talk to Amanda Staples about what's on her bedside table. You can hear Amanda next week on the podcast when she's going to be talking about her play, which has just been on in Bristol. But for now, Amanda, what's on your bedside table?
This is a fun one because this was on my Christmas list. My Christmas list was tea and books, and that was it. So I'm lucky I got some books. And I haven't read this author for a while. I used to read all of his stuff. He writes lots of different series. And this one is the number one ladies detective agency. So it's Alec Bandon, of course. His last book, I just heard it was Book of the Week on Radio 4. And I thought, I haven't read him for a while. I'm totally going to go and get the next book. So I put it on my Christmas list. So this one's called The Woman Who Walked in Sunshine. And I really like, for me, I read all sorts of things. I'm in a book club, so we read all sorts of things. I do a lot of crime and thrillers, contemporary stuff. Not always the thing that's, you know, in the news at the moment. I go right back into classics as well. And I tend to read to suit my mood. And I think because I've read a lot of quite heavy going stuff up to Christmas, and I was reading lots of Christmas books. I listened to Audible a lot, Walking the Dogs, so lots of stuff on there that I was following. And I thought, I just want a lighter read. And what you get from the detective agency stuff, which I think is different to the Scotland Street series, is you really just get this pure escapism and slight silliness every now and then, which is just, it's fun. It's just a really fun read. And I just find myself smiling the whole time. I just, you know, read to you going, I love this, you know. It's just one of the things that I'd read again. I don't read many things again, but I would certainly visit him. Or if it's on the radio, I'll go and listen again. Yeah. As I just love how he writes all the characters in there. And they've grown so much over the years.
Is. Brilliant. So Alexander McCall Smith, The Woman Who Walked in Sunshine.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Right, well, that's all we have time for this week. Thanks very much for joining us again. We'll look forward to welcoming you again next week. It's goodbye from us.
Bye.
See you all next week.